This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Folks, it is time to talk about one of my absolute favorite topics, snacks. Japanese snacks, specifically. You know, ever since I was a young lad who discovered the world of Japanese snacks, I've been obsessed with their adorable packaging, quirky vibes, and the incredible flavors that you just cannot find in U.S. supermarkets. That is why teaming up with our sponsor, Boxu, a Japanese snack subscription box, has been an absolute blast. Because these snacks aren't just your average grocery store finds. Every month, Boxu delivers over 20 unique treats straight from Japan. Plus, they include a handy guide filled with info about each snack and Japanese culture. Snacking and learning, literally my two favorite things, and I'm going to take a wild guess that those are two things you enjoy as well. Oh, and did I mention that each box ships free from Japan straight to your doorstep? It's incredible. And these snacks are so special, okay? One of them that I just cannot get out of my mind, they have this white chocolate strawberry. It's like a freeze-dried strawberry that is somehow injected with white chocolate. So it is both simultaneously strawberry and white chocolate. I cannot even describe to you what this tasted like. I have never had a textural or taste sensation like it. You gotta try it. And my favorite thing about Boxu, besides the amazing snacks, is that they support small, family-run businesses in Japan. Boxu has sourced your treats by working with over 245 small makers in Japan, helping out their businesses and helping to preserve their traditions. So if you love Japanese snacks as much as I do, or if you know someone who does, you have got to try out Boxu. Right now, you can use the code FACTUALLY for $15 off your first order on Boxu.com. That's FACTUALLY for $15 off your first order on Boxu.com. And let me know what you think of that strawberry. It is seriously good.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Hello and welcome to Factually. I'm Adam Conover. Thank you so much for joining me once again as I talk to an incredible expert about all the amazing things they know that I don't know and that you might not know. Today, we're going to be talking about hot dogs. That's right, a whole hour on America's iconic tubed meat. Love them or hate them, hot dogs are woven into American culture. They're the kid-friendly food boiled in water. They're a regular guest at baseball games and summer barbecues. For some, they're an easy budget meal option and an efficient use of slaughterhouse meats. But they're also a grotesque warning about everything that is wrong with how we treat the animals we eat and the workers who process them. What I'm saying is hot dogs simply are America in all its forms, good and bad, all right? And we're not just talking about them because it's summer and I'm hungry, though both things are true. We're talking about hot dogs because I just read an incredible book called Raw Dog by the comedian Jamie Loftus. Jamie, who you might know from her hit podcasts about Mensa, Kathy Comics, and the book Lolita, does investigative comedy in a way that is completely unique and totally fascinating. And in this book, the way she synthesizes history, food criticism, and incredibly funny comedy writing with a deep and unsettling investigation into the American meat industry is after my own heart and just incredibly fun to read. I know you're going to love this conversation, but before we get to it, I just want to remind you that if you want to support this show, you can do so on Patreon. Just $5 a month gets you every episode of this show ad-free. We even do a community book club. Please join us, patreon.com/Adam Conover. And if you enjoy stand-up comedy, just a reminder that I am on tour. If you want to come see me do stand-up near you, head to adamconover.net for tour dates and tickets. And now, let's get to my interview with Jamie Loftus. Jamie, thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm excited.
I'm very thrilled to have you here. You're one of my favorite investigative comedians. I think that's a term I sometimes apply to myself a little bit self-importantly. I don't love it that much, but I actually do apply it to you. I think we share a... Oh, thank you. Well, we share a similar sensibility of finding what is funny in what is true and weird about the world.
Mm-hmm.
You have this new book about hot dogs called Raw Dog. I love this book so much. I've never read a book like this before in my life, to be honest,
cool.
Where it's both a history of this disgusting food stuff where you alternately praise it and excoriate how horrible it is. It's also a memoir about your own fucked up life, if you don't mind me saying so.
No, totally it's
also,
correct.
It's also very funny. And guess what? It seems to be selling like hotcakes or like hot dogs. So congratulations to you. It's so cool
to have you
here to talk about it. And I hope you're happy with how the book is being received.
It's been so great. Yeah. I mean, like it's hard to know how a book about hot dogs is going to do. There's not many of them. I was hoping that would work in its favor, but you know, there's always the chance that there hadn't been many for a reason and no one wants them, but it's been so nice. It's been like a really nice summer of talking about hot dogs for the third summer in a row. It might just be forever.
Well, I think that exact emotion, well, no one wants a book about hot dogs and yet we're buying them. That's true about hot dogs themselves.
It's
Everyone
true.
Has a bad opinion of hot dogs. Ugh, disgusting. I don't like them.
Mm-hmm.
Could I please have some hot dogs? Like that's so what, I mean, what is it about this food that made you want to dive so deep into it? Is it that contradiction in the soul of the hot dog?
Yeah, I really like, I just like topics in general where people feel really strongly about something and are not sure why they feel strongly about it. And that feels very, a very hot dog coded sentiment to me, where everyone thinks they're disgusting. Everyone knows the same sort of five facts about why they're great or why they're gross. And then everyone eats them anyways. And I love that I had a strong feeling about hot dogs and I didn't know why. And sometimes you're like, oh, it connects to my relationship with my father. Other times it's just like, it's so, I don't know. It's an interesting little kind of canvas because I feel like everyone's feelings about hot dogs has something to do with who they are in a weirdly intimate way.
Yeah. And so much of the time, like, you know, one of my favorite parts of this book is you sort of reviewing different hot dog places around the country and describing mm-hmm. the hot dog and how it compares to other hot dogs. But you're also giving a personal history of your relationship with the hot dog. So sometimes you're just describing, you're at a very low point in your life. Something very depressing has happened to you. You're eating a hot dog, not because you like it, but you just needed something to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're also going, and it had an okay snap, but the bun was soggy. And
yeah.
you're combining personal history and food writing in this really fascinating way.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I've tried to, I don't know, like I felt like I would be deluding myself to go into it as if I were a food writer because I just wouldn't have done a very good job. And like, I have never been like a food writer in detail before this. And so, yeah, it was almost just like, well, what do I know how to do? And it just felt more like going to whatever stand-up brand or whatever it is instead of pretending that I have institutional knowledge that I definitely do not.
But you make an incredible case in this book for the hot dog as a fundamental American, like, regional food. Like, okay, like if you were going to say, I'm doing a book about pizza, I'm going to go to all different parts of the country and see all the different regional pizzas and talk about the history,
mm-hmm.
I'd be like, okay, I'm aware that pizzas are like, there's New York pizza, there's Long Island pizza, there's Chicago pizza, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's New Haven pizza for the people who really know. You know, there's all of this food culture around pizza. No one ever talks about hot dogs in the same breath.
No.
And yet you make a case in this book for, you go all across the country, you find different regional hot dog styles in every city that have interesting histories that are related to the place, that are delicious or less delicious, that one can debate or et cetera. You talk the Chicago dog, the DC Ben's Chili Bowl dog,
mm-hmm.
the Los Angeles street cart dog.
Mm-hmm.
And that is food writing. And you really elevated the hot dog in my mind as a fundamental American part of American cuisine.
Good. I'm glad. Yeah. I mean, I really do love the fucking things. They're so good. Like they're, and you try, well, I've been meaning to ask you, what did you think of your Ben's Chili Bowl experience? I forgot. Okay. I forgot to check in about it.
Because I was texting you.
Yeah.
Because I now text you, as I'm sure everyone does, every time I eat a hot dog.
Look, hot dog.
Every time I get a hot dog, I'm like, Jamie, you wrote a book about hot dogs. I'm here to, and by the way, we don't know each other that well, but we have each other's phone numbers. Mm-hmm. And, but here I am texting you, probably four out of every five texts I've texted you now over the entire course of our friendship has been me telling you, Jamie, I'm eating a hot dog. I wanted to let you know.
And I
text.
Love it. It's great.
You know, and it's similar, I think, to when people say to me, oh, here's the guy who ruins everything. Oh, you probably are sick of hearing that. And I mm-hmm. say, no, no, no. If you coin a catchphrase, you need to be grateful to hear it every time people repeat it back to you.
You have to live. Yes.
You have to live it. And I feel like you feel the same way.
Yes. I mean, I truly, there are so many things to be associated with in the world. And hot dogs is like one of the easiest things. It's like, it's truly not. Because yeah, anytime someone's like, aren't you sick of it? You're like, even when I am, it would be so ridiculous to be genuinely upset about it. Like it would be so ridiculous.
And people are walking down the street, they're getting a hot dog and they're thinking of you as they have a happy moment, or at the very least an intense moment with a hot dog they didn't like.
Yes.
So yes, my Ben's Chili Bowl experience is I'm on tour a lot. My favorite thing to do when I'm on tour is to eat regional food. Mm-hmm. But sometimes I'm just in the airport and that's my only opportunity to eat the regional food. For instance, I've had a Philly cheesesteak in the Philadelphia airport. Not the true Philly cheesesteak experience, but...
No, but that's so... I mean, I think it's so... Philly and DC, it's so hard because because then you have to get on a cross-country flight after eating an entire Philly cheesesteak. Like, you don't know what your body's going to do. You don't know what's going to happen, but it's your only opportunity. You have to do it. It's hard.
Exactly.
Ben's Chili Bowl at the airport is pretty violent intense, but like you have to go. I'm very glad
And that's what I did. I was in the DC airport. I had not spent the weekend in DC. I was coming back from Baltimore, but I was flying out of DC. Mm-hmm. And I was literally listening to the audiobook of your book. And I had been listening to the part with Ben's Chili Bowl. And then I was like, there's a Ben's Chili Bowl in the airport. But I didn't plan my time properly. So I was like, I was buying the chili dog 10 minutes before getting on the flight. And I was texting you saying, is it okay if I bring a full chili dog onto the plane? And you were like, do what you got to do.
Yeah.
And then what I ended up doing was eating it over a trash can because my flight was delayed by 5 minutes, which was good for that. Honestly, that delay saved everybody's life.
Yes. Then they didn't need to see what you had done. And you got to act like a little possum.
Yeah.
At the airport.
I really did like a possum. I literally was eating it like with my body contorted over the trash can so that the chili... Because a chili dog to go is a rough thing. They wrapped it in foil. it's one of those bags where I opened it. It was already wet inside the bag.
Yeah.
But let me tell you, I enjoyed the hot dog. As you said, it was a classic half smoke with chili. It had a good snap. The chili was tasty. I think a chili dog is generally too much.
Like, I agree.
But it was, and I will say, I have not had the regular Ben's Chili Bowl in DC, but I felt that it was pretty legit in terms of, it didn't feel like a downgrade. I was like, this must be as good as it is. It can't be any better than this at the actual store.
The airport one, I've also done the airport one in a very similar circumstance. And it's like, you shouldn't do it, but sometimes it's the only option and you can't leave without having the chili dog. So yeah, it's like, I thought the airport one was pretty good. It's definitely, a chili dog's always going to be too wet. And the vessel doesn't really make sense. You need a more toasted bun if you're going to put that much slop on top. But it's none of my business. And I think Ben's Chili Bowl rocks.
Just suddenly that became like you were doing a testimonial coming out of like a movie in the 90s going like Mission Impossible rocks. But you were doing it about Ben's Chili Bowl. But what I love about the book, though, let's just talk about Ben's Chili Bowl for a second, because this is a historic hot dog place in D.C., but you don't just say, hey, it's a good hot dog place and blah, blah, blah. You talk about the history of the place going back 50, 60 years and how this hot dog interacts with the history of the civil rights movement. Would you just like tell me that?
It's, yeah, Ben's Chili Bowl has a wild history. It's one of the, I think it's definitely the most famous Black-owned hot dog business in the country. I hope I'm not leaving anybody out. But yeah, it's been around forever. It was a big, big deal during the civil rights movement because it's been said, and it's like difficult to prove, but I'm like, yeah, sure, that the March on Washington was planned partially at Ben's Chili Bowl, and that they were sort of a hot spot for planning and organizing during the civil rights movement in the D.C. area. And so it has like kind of this incredible history, and they are very forward with that history. And then sort of as I was sort of tracing the history as it went on, you can see how aggressively gentrified the area got over the years, how, you know, sort of in, I think it was like the 90s and early 2000s, there was a big wave of white 20-somethings moving into the area. And, you know, sort of the whole gentrification story as we know it now. And now it's, you know, they're across the street from a bank that is like, we love gay people. And you're like, great. Thank you, bank. It's this relic is not the word I want to use. It's like this iconic business that's in the middle of such a wildly changing landscape, but it's constant. Yeah. It's still owned by the family. It's still partially run by one of the original co-founders. And yeah, I mean, it's just like it got this really cool history. And so many hot dog places do, because they've all been around forever. They all like, especially in DC, where, you know, every president that has, like, it's, I think, one of sort of the first stops. If you are elected president, you go to Ben's Chili Bowl because it's important that you have a hot dog because it proves that you're American. Like, it's there's all this weird stuff tied into it.
Mm-hmm. The history of the hot dog is, in fact, the history of America, is what you're saying. Did I make it too grand?
No. Yeah, you sound like the guy who runs the Nathan's hot dog contest.
Oh, let's get into that in a second.
Yeah.
I want to tease that for later in the interview. If people want to hear all the Nathan's hot dog contest dirt, you got to stick around a little bit. Oof. But what I want to ask is, one of my favorite parts of the book at the beginning is you debunk many stories of the history of the hot dog, which I love, because for every food stuff, there are hundreds of people saying, I invented it. And they're all full of shit. They're all just restaurateurs who are trying to make them. Oh, we invented the Caesar salad. No, you fucking didn't.
Yeah.
So you actually debunk some and you reveal the true history of the hot dog, which perhaps for the first time ever. So what is the history of the hot dog?
The history of the hot dog, I mean, it underwent the same sort of series of trial and error bullshit narratives where it was like, it was one guy who was holding a sausage in a glove and his hand got hot. And you're just like, that's not even a good story. That's not.
It's always, also the fake story is always like a mistake.
Yeah.
You know, it's always like, oh, someone came in and they wanted a sausage, but we didn't have any because it was Tuesday. So one crazy guy decided, and that's always fucking bullshit.
And the world was never the same. Yeah. And, but I mean, even the myths were, I mean, they're fascinating because they, I mean, not only do they all kind of suck, but they are connected to very American feeling scenarios. So many of them are tied to like the World's Exhibition in Chicago in 1893. A lot of them are connected to early baseball games in the U.S. Like, it's all connected to this idea of American exceptionalism and then putting this bullshit story about this American dish there. But the truth is that it was just, the hot dog was brought over from just countries with sausage traditions in Europe. So mainly Germany and Poland. And, you know, there was a huge wave of immigration, and it just sort of became a dish that evolved into street cart food, especially kind of during the Great Depression when there was a need, when, you know, as the country was industrializing, poor people needed something delicious to eat. And so it evolved out of those traditions. It wasn't one specific person. It wasn't one specific company. You can sort of trace it to like New York and New Jersey. I'll give them that. But outside of that, it was this sort of over time collective need to be able to eat something on the go in the city as a poor person. And that's where it came from.
And one of the things I found really fascinating about this is that hot dogs are everywhere across America. If you look at a lot of our other, first of all of our best foods are poor people foods, right? Our working class foods. If you look at, you know, pizza, bagels, anything that people like, even ramen as a dish, right? If you look at the history of ramen in Japan, right? It's always a working class meal. What can we put out quickly that then, you know, innovative chefs improvise on and et cetera.
Right.
Those are the best foods everywhere in the world, bar none. But usually in the U.S., they're somewhat regional. You know, like pizza is, you know, there's New York style pizza, New Jersey, Chicago, et cetera. But we wouldn't say, oh, Los Angeles or San Francisco or, I don't know, Louisiana have like, you know, well-established regional pizza styles, right? It's right. We see these as pizza deserts.
and it's really sad that we don't talk about it enough.
We don't talk about the issue of pizza deserts enough. And someone needs to start a foundation to deal with this problem. But you made the case that hot dogs are everywhere. Almost every city has some sort of regional hot dog style that is distinct and interesting. There are no hot dog deserts. And why do you think that is?
There's definitely places where hot dogs aren't as popular, but I don't know. I mean, I think that that's a great question. I'm not totally sure why hot dogs are truly everywhere. I think because after a while they were considered such an American symbol that their association with Greek and Polish and Austrian immigrants, that sort of went, I mean, that like was less popularly associated with the dish. And then it just became like this little sausage thing is the American dish. And I think that that is probably why it spread everywhere, because it became associated with the 4th of July. It became associated with American summers and all of these really, I don't know, things that you don't, or that I didn't really think about as like something that's bonked into your head when you're very young of like, this is a summer dish. This is, and especially if you are in like a low income family, like it's a dish for whenever. It's really easy to make it. It's really affordable. And I think that it probably spread at least in part because of its association with American holidays and American summers for better and for worse. There's like, and there definitely is. I mean, I didn't get everywhere that I wanted to for the hot dog book. And every single day, probably for the rest of my life, I will receive at least one email about like, why did you not go to where? Why didn't you go to Kansas to get the Kansas hot dog? And like, I don't.
The book can only be so long, ma'am.
I cut a lot of hot dogs, hit the cutting room floor. It was a brutal process. I couldn't include
imagine
them all.
Your feet just surrounded by chopped up hot dog chunks.
That's kind of what our car was like at different points in the trip. Just a meat detritus. But yeah, I mean, like every single, at least like major city or region has their hot dog. And even places that you wouldn't think would be, I mean, like LA, I feel like is a very underrated hot dog heaven. There's so many great hot dogs in LA. More people eat hot dogs per capita in LA than anywhere in the country, New Yorkers don't want to hear, and they're not ready to have that conversation. But it's true, and it's kind of
and also in LA, there's a kind of street hot dog for folks who haven't been to LA that you see all over the place. It's usually middle-aged older ladies with carts, and it's got a hot surface, and they're grilling peppers and onions, and then they've got bacon-wrapped hot dogs.
Yes.
And these will be outside, you know, clubs, like places where people are partying, and they'll also be outside every single Dodger game, soccer game, any kind of game. Like if you leave an LAFC game, this is a soccer team I go to see often, there's just like a phalanx, like just of 100 women just going, hot dog, hot dog, hot dog, hot dog. And you can get a hot dog. And here's the thing. People talk shit on these hot dogs. People call them danger dogs. Yeah, people say, oh, that's a danger dogs. They say, ah, it's not going to be good. And I've had one, and you know, it's I'll say it's not the best hot dog I've ever had in my life, but it's a solid hot dog. And you make the point, these are better than the hot dogs that they serve inside the sports stadium by a mile. And
easily,
they're a lot better as a New Yorker. They're a lot better than the street hot dogs in New York, which are just those Sabrette dirty water dogs. That is not a quality hot dog. They taste like propane. And I'm saying this as a New Yorker.
I was like, that's
all right? I'm
really
allowed
brave
to say
of
this.
You to say.
Yeah. They're not good.
I don't and like so, them.
Yeah.
But I'm so I live in fear of insulting the wrong hot dog, and like someday someone's gonna come for me. It's gonna be bad. But yeah, the street hot dogs in LA are incredible, and I'm always stunned at what a well-oiled machine it is. Where it's truly anywhere in the entire city where you might get drunk, there is a hot dog cart outside. Like you're good. It's covered. I think my last street dog was like after I went to like WrestleMania at SoFi, and it was just like a million hot dog vendors. It was incredible. I really like Danger Dogs. Dodger Dogs. I've already Dodger Dogs and Pink's, just trash, not good. I think that maybe that's why LA kind of suffers, because our two most sort of famous hot dogs suck. But there's so many good ones.
And you use this as, now, first of all, one of the reasons these street hot dogs are really good, there are hot grilled peppers and onions on the hot dog. It's not just simply a hot dog on some cold bun.
Mm-hmm.
It's like it's a whole dish that you can only get in this one circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
But you use that as a way to talk about street vendors in Los Angeles more generally, the history of street food carts,
mm-hmm.
And the precarity that those vendors live under, the way that they've always been harassed by the city. Tell me a little bit about that, because I found that fascinating.
Yeah, I had gotten into, I think I'd written a story about like food vendors in LA like years before. So I knew a little bit about it, but I never had like laser focused it onto hot dogs, because why would you? But this was my chance. And what I found frustrating and interesting was that there, you know, so many of the mythic stories that these famous hot dog places have, especially ones that have been around for, you know, 80, 90, 100 years, began as carts that were run by immigrants. And that is still the case of most hot dog carts across the country. But in the case of, I used Pink's as kind of an example for how this. How Pink's, I mean, it's a very famous LA hot dog institution. They started as a cart in 1939. They're kind of known as like the hot dog vendor to the stars, which I guess someone has to be. I don't know.
When Brad Pitt wants a hot dog, you know who he calls? His friend, Bob Pink. I don't know the guy's name. Please go on.
It may in fact be Bob Pink. You can go to Pink's right now, and you shouldn't, but you could, and you could get the Rosie O'Donnell, and it's just a hot dog Rosie O'Donnell likes. And I think that's interesting, but anyways.
Wait, what's on the Rosie O'Donnell?
Wait, I have to check, because I've had it and I was like, what is she doing?
You've had it and you have to check.
Yes, I've had so many celebrity. Okay, and then they're famous for the Betty White hot dog, which is bare. Absolutely nothing.
A plain hot dog.
Just a plain hot dog. Which I guess
Betty, you know, Betty White was, I'm sure, watching her health towards the end.
So the thing with the Rosie O'Donnell dog is it's really long for some reason. It's just like it's much
like Rosie's career.
It's yes.
Right?
Yeah. I think it was supposed to be a symbol for her longevity as a cultural figure.
Yeah, she had a daytime talk show. Yeah. She was in League of Their Own.
Her versatility.
You know, The View.
Yeah. So it's long, and then it's sort of like a standard like chili kraut onion mustard dog. But it's long. And why is that? But anyways, Pink's. They have all these celebrity hot dogs. Now it's like they've franchised. It's this big institution. But they started as a cart. And now I think that it's like they're in their third generation of ownership. They've been around for over 80 years. And now the current owners of Pink's make it sort of their business to get hot dog carts owned by immigrants off the streets to eliminate competition.
What?
And yeah. And, you know, the current owners of Pink's they just love the LAPD so much. And like, you see this, like these institutions that started because it was possible for immigrants to start a small business like a hot dog cart and thrive and grow it out over a course of years. And you see those same businesses trying to prevent that from happening down the line. And I found that incredibly frustrating. And also, I guess the more I read about it, you're like, oh yeah, three generations of hot dog nepotism. And they're so far removed that they're now, you know, making it their business to get rid of other vendors. And then there's also great stories about vendors organizing and actually getting big wins from the city, which they have in LA. I mean, it's been back and forth, but over the last couple of years, there's been like some good movement there. And I don't know. Yeah, I want to. I wish I knew more about street vendors. It's so fascinating and so frustrating to, especially during COVID, like how there were all of these bizarro loopholes that were taken advantage of at the city level to get street vendors off the street at a time where business is extremely diminished and making it seem like it's a safety issue versus what it actually is.
And what is it actually? Like, what is the actual motivation for the city or the cops to harass street vendors?
Well, I think it's because they are immigrants, and I think it's because they're poor. And I think, and that has always been the case. And I read, you know, going back 100 years in LA, this has like been the case forever, but it's still the case now. The reasoning that the cops and the city will give for doing it tends to change over time. But it was extra frustrating to me that there wasn't even, you know, a ton of solidarity from successful hot dog businesses and these carts, because that's what, you know, would be like if Pink's was actually in solidarity with street cart vendors, that would mean something and that would make a big difference. But
yeah,
they want to eliminate competition, and so they're not.
But the soul of the hot dog is the small vendor. And
yes,
that's one of the things I find so fascinating, because almost every business that you profile here, you talk about a couple big institutions like Nathan's or Pink's that are big in their region. Nathan's is a chain. But most of the places you're talking about are mom and pop shops, street vendors, small places. And that is the soul of the hot dog. I read a really interesting, as I'm the sort of person, I read an article 10 years ago. I don't remember where it was, but I remember the gist, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the gist, somebody at some point wrote an article that was like, how come there's no fast food hot dog chain?
Yeah.
Right? If you were to write a book about burgers, you would have to deal with McDonald's, Burger King, Wendy's, not just that, but Shake Shack, Five Guys, In-N-Out. When people are debating the best burger spot, they're always talking about Shake Shack versus In-N-Out. Who gives a shit? That's not interesting.
Yeah.
Those are giant companies. Mm-hmm. But there is no, I mean, there's Nathan's, sure, small chain, Wiener Schnitzel, I guess. I've never been to a Wiener Schnitzel. Who gives a shit?
Wiener Schnitzel's pretty busted. Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah,
that's not a real fast food chain, right?
Yeah.
So it is fascinating that there is no like McDonald's of hot dogs, despite the fact that this is a quintessential American convenience food.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
That I've been trying to get to the bottom of forever. Like, there are instances of hot dogs being test drived at places like McDonald's. There was, I forget what region it was, but there was a time where McDonald's was trying out hot dogs at McDonald's in certain regions, and it flopped and no one wanted it. And they were like, which makes sense.
If you went into a McDonald's and they were like, hey, try the hot dog, we've got a hot dog now, I would walk out of the McDonald's.
Yeah, like,
that would be disturbing to me.
I'd be like, man, I'm already here. Like, don't make this harder.
But they flopped. Yeah. Why do you feel they flopped?
I don't know. I mean, I read about a series of, I mean, it's certainly been attempted before. There are small franchises. There's like the Dog House in Southern California. There's a couple of those. There's a couple of Pink's, but yeah, they never really got successful past regional. I don't really observe Wiener Schnitzel as a business that exists because, like you're saying, I don't know anyone who's ever been there. And I've never passed one and seen people inside. So I feel like it doesn't really count.
I've seen like the building. I'm like, that used to be a Wiener Schnitzel because
yes,
it's in a weird building.
Yes.
Like that bank was once a Wiener Schnitzel.
I don't know why it is, but I think that it, because it was never really cracked, of like a national hot dog chain, it sort of reinforces the feeling that everyone thinks that their favorite hot dog is a secret. And that, like, I feel like it almost, because I mean, whatever, I feel very personally attached to certain fast food dishes. There's like, everyone's very connected to their Taco Bell order. It's not like you can't have an emotional connection with fast food, but it does feel like, with hot dogs, they're like, well, this is my hot dog and you probably don't know about it, but blah, 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 blah. And I feel like it sort of works in the hot dog's favor too, because it means that if you have a favorite hot dog, you're probably statistically likely to be supporting a small business, which is great.
Yeah. And it means it makes it such a more interesting food to learn. I mean, burgers are everywhere and they're either, you know, fast food or they're just, you know, like, I don't know. It's a less interesting thing to examine, but like a business that is successful and longstanding and is making hot dogs, they must be doing something interesting, right? There's got to be, they're not just slinging dogs. They're like, there's either a regional connection or they're doing something very special with the dish that they're making that's causing people to come back again and again.
Yeah, or someone like, or something local happened there, or someone important had been there or not, and they're lying about it, or the place burned down, which like so many of these places burned down over and over and over. There's a place that I really loved in Baltimore that like, I think it had burned down two or three different times, and they had like framed pictures of the times that it had burned down, like, because it was just a part of the canon of this deli, was that it seemed to burn down at random constantly. It's great. Like, it's, you can't get that from a McDonald's.
Wouldn't it be cool if every McDonald's burned down all at once and then they all had to rebuild? Well, we got to take a quick break. When we get back, I want to talk about the awful truth about how hot dogs are made. But we got to read some ads. We'll be right back with Jamie Loftus. Folks, I'm honored to say that the podcast is sponsored this week by The Washington Post. If you're a Factually listener, you're already a person who aims to stay informed, aware, and engaged. But let me bring you in on a little secret. Beside the fantastic guests I have on this show, the number one way that I stay engaged is through reading the news like The Washington Post. Their journalists bring you the facts and provide clarity about what's happening on Capitol Hill, the economy, climate change, foreign policy, and everything else that I and you care about. You know, here on Factually, we love to go deep on topics, and the Washington Post helps me and helps you go deeper on the news that matters most to you. That's why I start my days by warming up my brain by reading great articles from some of the best journalists out there in the Post. In fact, many of my favorite past guests on this show, like Taylor Lorenz and David Weigel, have contributed to The Washington Post. That's how good their journalists are. You know, I've also found that adding The Washington Post app to the home screen on my phone has been a great way to cut my social media time. Instead of scrolling through social media on the bus, I get to learn more about the world around me. It is absolutely incredible and makes that commute time so much more enjoyable and fruitful. I also love the Post's newsletters, like The 7, which is a quick commute read that they send each weekday morning and is also available as a podcast. I even signed up to get the Post's For You newsletter, which sends me my very own personalized roundup of stories every evening based on my interests in reading history. So if all of that sounds good to you, well, now is the time to sign up for The Washington Post. Go to WashingtonPost.com/factually to subscribe for just 50 cents a week for your first year. That is 80% off their typical offer. So this is truly a steal. Once again, that is WashingtonPost.com/factually to subscribe for just 50 cents a week for your first year. Shout out to Claritin for supporting this episode and providing us with samples. You know, I never used to have allergies, but then suddenly in my 30s, I started getting walloped with them every single spring. I'll step outside on a beautiful day, ready to hop on the bus or head down to the podcast studio, and suddenly I have a runny nose, scratchy eyes, and it makes it pretty hard to have a conversation with our guests when I am so bogged down and distracted with allergies. Well, luckily for those of us who live with those symptoms, which now includes me, we can live Claritin Clear with Claritin D. This double-action combination of prescription-strength allergy medicine and the best decongestant available relieves sneezing, a runny nose, itchy and watery eyes, an itchy nose and throat, and sinus congestion and pressure with ease. So when I've got a big interview with a big guest, I look for relief with Claritin D. In as little as 30 minutes, I'm refreshed, I'm renewed, and I no longer sound like some kind of cartoon duck. So if you are ready to live life as if you don't have allergies, it is time to live Claritin Clear.
Fast and powerful relief is just a quick trip away. You can find Claritin D at your pharmacy counter and you don't even need a prescription. So go to Claritin.com right now for a discount so you can live Claritin clear. That's Claritin.com. Use as directed.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
I remember when I moved to New York City and I got a hot dog once in the street because I was hungry and I was in a hurry and it was so bad. I didn't have another one for 10 years.
Wow.
And I never knew anybody else who did either.
That propane like scent and flavor is very real. It's not good.
Yeah. It's. I feel that they are only eaten by tourists. I feel that people in New York do not actually eat them. People in New York eat dollar pizza. That's a local, a local convenience food. Mm-hmm. Bagels, certainly. Bacon, egg, and cheese, mm-hmm. right? Chopped cheese, bodega sandwiches. These are the run and go, grab and go meals that New Yorkers eat.
Mm-hmm.
But not. I just would never even see anybody eating a hot dog.
Yeah.
I'm gonna leave this part in because I want people to hear my expanded thoughts on the New York City hot dog.
Mm-hmm.
You can tweet at me if you disagree. But we got to get back into it with Jamie Loftus. We're talking. I got to know about how hot dogs are made. You had a harrowing examination of this process. Tell me about it.
Yes. So I feel like that is one of the commonly shared things about hot dogs and why people claim to avoid them, although I don't think they actually do, is that it's it's processed meat. And so the conditions and, in the way that they're made in American factories, just the way a hot dog is made anywhere is most likely not ethical for the animal and often for the employees who work at meat processing plants as well. And it was originally my plan that now I was like, what did I think was going to happen? To interview people who worked in at plants as well as hopefully touring one myself just to see what is the, sort of sanitized version of how this is shown to journalists. But I was only met with slammed doors when it came to that because I was researching it at a uniquely bad time mm-hmm. for meat processing, which I vaguely remembered. I mean, so I did the reporting for this in the back half of 2021, where I was touring around over the summer, getting the hot dogs, learning the stories, ingratiating myself in the culture, and then spent the rest of the year writing my first draft of the book and doing research and interviews around meat processing. And I remembered, I don't know, I feel like I was constantly confronted with how much from early COVID lockdown I had it like willfully blocked out because mm-hmm. it was just so much, like so much bad news every single day, all the time. And so I remembered that in April 2020, there had been an executive order from Trump saying that meat processing plants had to stay open no matter what, like with the underlying, again, it being that American thing, like Americans need their meat, they need their hot dogs. And I remember that being true, but I didn't really follow up on what that meant for the people who worked there. What that meant for the people who worked there, especially at Tyson and Smithfield plants, was that COVID spread like wildfire. There was little to nothing done to protect employees who were majority immigrants. There was a lot of, I've done a lot of subsequent talks with meatpacking union organizers and how there has been sort of an institutional struggle to make sure that language barriers are being addressed within unionizing efforts. But that executive order was essentially a blank check for Tyson and Smithfield CEOs to mistreat their employees. And at one point, I think that meatpacking was like the second most dangerous job you could have in the U.S. during lockdown.
The conditions in those plants were just like perfect for COVID to be spread because it was something about the cold. It was like wet air from the humidity and then people in close quarters constantly breathing, doing in many cases physical work, which would cause them to breathe a little bit heavier, being in the same place with other people for like 8 hours at a stretch. Like it was just a COVID incubation chamber and none of those places shut down because of the executive order that you're talking about.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, there is and the year after it, in 2022, when I was finishing up the book, there was a ProPublica report that essentially confirmed that Tyson and Smithfield had drafted this executive order and sent it to the Trump White House and it got pushed through. So it was at the highest level. An opportunity was seen to sell more product. And they were successful too. Like hot dog sales doubled during lockdown. I know that
hot dog sales doubled during lockdown. Why?
Yeah. I think that there's a comfort element to it. I think it's a combination of comfort and finances, where if you were operating on a reduced income during lockdown, which almost everybody was, like they were still cheap and they were still possible to get because of this executive order. So it becomes this whole snake eating its own tail thing where it's like the sales did go way up and the executive order from the business, from the CEO's perspective was very successful. But the way that that was accomplished was by literally, you know, essentially willfully killing their own employees. And so it's really, I mean, there's been a lot written about it, but I still haven't seen it be a real public discussion. And going back, because that was like the specific moment that I was covering, but I, again, just felt very naive in that. I was just like, I thought that after The Jungle was published, it was not as bad. But of course, that's not true. In many ways, it's worse than it's ever been. And tracing the history of meatpacking labor, where, you know, this is a formerly very, very strong union job that you can have. And, you know, when The Jungle was published 100 years ago, there were two significant laws pushed through to protect both livestock and the employees of the meat processing plants, but there's been basically no meaningful legislation in that space since then, which I was genuinely very surprised at. And also that, I don't know, I had to reread The Jungle because I realized that I guess I had like lied about reading it in high school. I definitely was supposed to.
I never read it. Were we supposed to read it? They just told us about it. They were just like, this book, Upton Sinclair, Yellow Journalism, Hot Dogs, I don't know, whatever. But nobody, we didn't read it in my school.
For some reason, I thought I had read it. And then I read it. I was like, no, this is like trying to get poor Americans at the turn of the century to become socialists. Like the hot dog part is a very, very small element of that book.
But that's the part that people, as you write, latched onto, that Upton Sinclair was trying to like cause the working class to rise up and wage revolution. And so people read the book and they were like, oh, meat.
That's what's in the hot dog.
Our meat. Yeah, that's what's in the hot dog. The meat is disgusting. We got to fix this. And that's all that happened.
Which is like, I don't know what I expected. But it is very funny that it like is this very comprehensive like piece trying to sell the working class on socialism as a concept. And it ended up passing two hot dog laws. But they were important.
They're important laws. Not just hot dogs, all meat. They covered all meat.
Yes. Yeah. And those are
really important laws that are still enforced today. But there's been very, very little that has happened since then. And now with sort of the rise of technology, sure, whatever, there have been laws not to use tech to protect employees or animals, but to actively, there's been legislation pushed through called ag laws that are designed to prevent employees from recording anything inside of a meat processing plant and making it, you know, legally actionable, and you would certainly lose your job. And also to prevent journalists or anyone trying to investigate what's going on inside of them, yeah, and making it truly like illegal to know what's going on inside of a lot of these factories. And some of them are getting rolled back, but like that's the most significant legislation. Yeah.
It's one of those things where, you know, in America, when we don't want society to know about something, we sequester it, we segregate it. You know, if you look at prisons, right, prisons are often, mm-hmm, you know, way off in upstate New York or somewhere else remote. You know, it's like there'll be like the prison and the town around it that services the prison. And then, you know, no one else ever has to think about it. There's very little reporting about it. That's by design. Same thing is true of meat processing, that like where it's, yeah, done is in these giant facilities. The entire town just exists to service it. It's all worked by, you know, mostly recent immigrants who, mm-hmm, you know, their only community is each other and the little town that they live in. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, they take steps to prevent unionization, to prevent those folks from having too strong of a community. And as a result, like we're all eating this stuff, but by design, we're not able to see where it actually comes from. And when on my Netflix show, The G Word, we went to a Cargill beef processing plant. Mm-hmm. And by the way, we went to go see beef because we were told that pork and chicken would be too disgusting to put on television.
They may have been right about that.
No, I think they were probably right. And oh, you know, just for visual reasons, we went to go see beef.
Yeah.
And we, you know, we saw quite a lot of the process, but they told us this is the first time we've allowed cameras in here in about 30 years. Mm. And we only went because we were profiling the USDA. We did talk about some of the abuses that you're talking about. We're profiling the good work that people at the USDA do in there. But you also get a sense that the conveyor belt, the machinery of capitalism pushing these, you know, animals in one end and meat out the other end is so vast and has to move so quickly that any attempt to regulate the process to make it safer and saner and more ethical just falls by the wayside.
Yeah.
You know, this industry is basically just able to control the entire process. You know, the well-being of humans or animals be damned.
Yeah, I mean, I watched that episode and I was, but I think I saw that as I was writing the book. I think that times out right. I was like, how did they get in there? Like, it's so hard. And
yeah,
I mean, it's incredible that you were able to, because there's like, and I always wonder, I'm like, I always think of like the Elizabeth Holmes example of like Joe Biden was visiting the Theranos offices and she had people over in the next room making it look like it was a real thing when it wasn't. And so they were always like one room ahead and like just barely making it seem like it was like a functional thing that basically existed. And I'm so curious what that how like a formal tour squares with what an employee sees. And it seems like it does vary pretty wildly based on the company, because it's not like obviously, if you're not vegan, it's all unacceptable. But if you're a meat eater, there are places, especially, you know, like I think one of the good things about hot dogs being so sort of centralized to small businesses is it's not at all uncommon for them to source meat locally and in a far more ethical way. And like you can know exactly where the meat is coming from. And it's a point of pride for a lot of business owners to tell you like, yeah, that cow used to live here, and you're like, awesome, cool.
But also, the best hot dog I had in LA recently was somebody had hired a hot dog cart to come to the picket line. Mm-hmm. As I was eating picket in front of the Netflix building, I was eating hot dogs. I was like, these are great hot dogs. Where'd you get them? And the guy was like, these are Kirkland Signature. Like these are the best hot dog I've tried all the hot dogs, and Kirkland Signature is the best one around. I'm like, all right, he's eating the Costco hot dogs. You know what
right?
I mean?
Well, it's like, and that is like, that's the Costco hot dog. Is it made as ethically? No. And, but it's like, it's with hot dogs, it's unavoidable in the same way that it's like, yeah, I still go to McDonald's. I know that I'm like committing, I'm, you know, complicit yeah. in something. But also you're like, but they're hot dogs for the union. How bad could it be? It's so, it's so hard. It's impossible.
I mean, you know, I love that your book has this tension between your knowledge of where the hot dog comes from and the fact that, hey, you got to eat, you know, as we all do. And that, you know, look, I admire anybody who goes vegan and renounces hot dogs in their entirety, but I don't think that that sort of monkish approach to life, you know, where we all face this conflict in our life somewhere, whether we choose to have that conflict over hot dogs or choose to have it over the clothes we buy or, you know, any of the other oppressive systems we live under, right? We're always confronting that contradiction at some point and having to make our peace with it and figure out how we live an ethical life in spite of it. And I thought it was really fascinating to see you grapple with that right here. I mean, how do you, you know, what goes through your mind now when you eat a hot dog, right? When you take that bite, do you imagine those workers getting the COVID, or how do you try to think about it?
I still, when I'm eating a hot dog, think, awesome. This is awesome for me. But I mean, there's, I think that, yeah, again, it's like finding out like, okay, if I am going to continue to eat meat, what is a way that I, because of what I have aggressively learned, what is a way that I can better, you know, interact with meat. And so, I mean, yeah, for hot dogs, especially, it's like, I will, if I possibly can, avoid the mass produced ones. And especially Tyson and Smithfield. I really do everything I can to not fuck with Tyson and Smithfield food products at all.
But hold on a second. These companies are like virtual monopolies. Like if you're eating meat of any kind in America, you're getting some Tyson and Smithfield.
It's true. It's like extremely hard to avoid. And also you have to do the internal math of like, oh, Smithfield owns Nathan's hot dogs. Did I eat Nathan's hot dogs this year? Yes, I did. It's like, yeah, it's very, very difficult. And so for me, I try to, buy local when I can, and I will like travel with hot dogs from places that I like. It's a mess. It's a mess. There's really no way to be, I mean, and I think that extends to like, there's no way to really be a meat eater in an industrialized society without being complicit in something. So yeah, I mean, I don't know that I have a good answer necessarily. I do think that it's good that more people seem to be talking about it, or at least thinking about it. At the 2022 Nathan's contest, there was a Smithfield protester that stormed the stage wearing a Darth Vader mask for some reason, and was put in a chokehold by Joey Chestnut, and it ended up being amazing for that cause, because people are like, wait, what the fuck was that? And then ended up learning about Smithfield food and all the how they're like egregiously bad, specifically with how they treated their employees during COVID. And you know, I do feel like there is something to people just knowing more. And I guess, yeah, where it's like one of the most common things for people to say about hot dogs is like, oh, aren't there dogs in it? You're like, no, it's worse. Sit down. Let me tell you.
Well, look, you mentioned the Costco hot dog.
Yes.
We have to talk about the Costco hot dog because there's a myth going around the internet about it that you bust. What is the myth and what is the truth?
Oh, well, okay. So there's that whole, the story itself probably is true, but there, how it is a very glorified folktale with the Costco hot dog that I forget. It's always like one's the CEO, one's the president, some weird corporate thing. But two higher ups at Costco, one was saying, you know, we have to raise the price of the hot dog. We're losing money. It's always been $1.50. That's been the deal. And then I think the CEO or the founder of Costco said, if you raise the price of the Costco hot dog, I will fucking kill you. I think is exactly what he said.
I've seen TikToks about this, but people go, oh, that Costco CEO loves you and your cheap hot dog so much, he threatened to murder his own president if you raise the price of the hot dog.
It's been that story comes up all the time. It's an incredibly effective, especially like, I was really surprised because there's people that like, I know that love that story. And there's like young people that love that story and like a whole generation that's been conditioned to fucking hate CEOs that are like, but this guy rules. And you're like, guys, come on. Like it blows my mind. But I think that is just the power of the hot dog where it's like that. Oh, the whole purpose of that story, whether it's true or not, repeated is to endear you to this CEO. Like,
yeah,
it's bizarre.
What is the real story behind why the Costco hot dog has been $1.50 for so long?
So it's it feels like I forget what the phrase is, but it's basically like a little psychological trick that is played on Costco members because you can't buy a Costco hot dog unless you're a Costco member. If you want to be a Costco member, you have to pay like $75 a year or something like that. And not everything at Costco is a great deal. It just is a lot of something. And so there is like a specific word for this, but by having at the entrance a freakishly good deal on a hot dog sort of conditions you to think you're about to get amazing deals top to bottom all throughout the Costco.
Loss leader. That's, I believe, the term, isn't it?
Yes.
It's a loss leader. They're losing money on the hot dog, but that makes you think you're getting such a great deal that you'll go and waste money on a gigantic tub of cheese balls.
Exactly. So you'll buy 10 pounds of pretzel sticks.
At exorbitant prices.
Yeah.
Because your belly is full of $1.50 hot dogs.
Exactly. Yeah. You're tricked into thinking that you're getting a good deal everywhere. But you just had a pretty solid hot dog. I do like the Costco hot dog.
But I also find this fascinating because it is locating the hot dog within the history of American poverty foods. I mean, this is like a Depression era deal, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It reminds me of these stories. Used to hear stories about how saloons, like drinking establishments throughout America, used to have a free lunch, mm-hmm. which is where the phrase "there ain't no such thing as a free lunch" comes from, because mm-hmm. it was not, in fact, free. You had to buy one drink, but then you got to eat the free lunch.
Yeah.
And it was just like a buffet sitting out of probably gross food or whatever.
Yeah.
But there's a history in America of this very, very cheap food as a way to get people into a business. And mm-hmm. so like, this is like through the 30s all over again with this Costco hot dog.
And we're still falling for it. And I do, I mean, I wonder sort of because we are in a recession and it's such a precarious time, that seems like when the hot dog really comes alive again. Hot dog is not associated with times of plenty.
You're saying your book is a bad indicator of the American economy. That's what you're saying. The fact that your book is a hit says something very bad about our society right now, that things were going down the tubes.
I really do think that my book doing well does not bode well for the country.
We're almost out of time. I have to ask you, because I teased it earlier, about the Nathan's hot dog contest.
Yes.
You tore the lid off of this story. We cannot possibly cover the whole thing, the amount of time we have left. You talk about the racist jingoism inherent in the victory of Joey Chestnut over Kobayashi,
mm-hmm.
the Japanese hot dog eating hero. Who I saw once defeated by you make an allusion to him being defeated by a bear on television. I saw this very reality show where he was defeated by a bear eating hot. This
on
one of the funniest
Spike?
Things. It was on. Yeah, I thought it was on Fox, but maybe he did it twice. It was one of the funniest things I've ever seen. Was Kobayashi, who at the time was a big media hero for destroy. He was the Babe Ruth of hot dogs, right?
Unbelievable.
He came out and ate dozens and dozens of hot dogs when other people had eaten like a third of what this guy was eating. So he was mm-hmm. he was huge in the media. So they do a reality show called like Man versus Beast or something like that, where he has to go up against, it's people going up against animals. and it's Kobayashi up against a bear eating hot dogs. And so Kobayashi's sitting there stuffing his face with hot dogs, like, you know, like dipping the bun in water and all that shit, and like just like eating them like a machine. The bear just sort of like ambles up to the hot dog tray and does nothing for 45 seconds and then just goes like, and eats like 200 hot dogs in two bites.
It's
and
amazing.
Kobayashi loses. And then here's what was funny to me was the announcers go, oh, too bad, Kobayashi. I guess you're not the champion anymore. Oh, you were so great, but you've been defeated by the bear. And Kobayashi is just like, what? I spent my life training for this. You're comparing me to a bear. This is not a fair comparison. Mm-hmm. It's a fun stuff. They were treating it like he really lost his championship belt to the bear.
To the bear.
It was so disrespectful to him.
That broadcast, and also like Kobayashi is amazing in situations like that because he's such a showman that you're just like, is he serious about being upset about this? And the like, even just like the jingoistic like air of that broadcast, it's so like, it's horrible and it's so silly at the same time, where they pull out when Kobayashi loses and you see that the bear is somehow representing America. And you're like, how? Kobayashi is representing
Grizzly, presumably.
Japan, and the bear is representing the U.S. And so that is why he lost the championship. It's so bizarre. Yeah. No, I mean, I'm very obsessed with the Nathan's contest. I was there this year, and I have sort of slowly been trying to be more to just know as much as I humanly can about that
you're a fan.
World.
You're very critical of the contest and its jingoism and the fact that it's, you know, elevates this homegrown hero, Joey Chestnut, who eats a wonderful amount of hot dogs, but is,
sure does.
You know, the way he's been presented as the great white hope, frankly, against Kobayashi. But at the same time, you're a fan and you have a crush on Joey Chestnut and you met him. So what was that like?
I do. It was so great. It was awesome. It was the best day of my life. I am still, as far as a hot dog eating fan, Kobayashi is the greatest of all time. As far as my crush on Joey Chestnut is, well, it's just true. Like, it's true. Like, not even in a way that I'm not even trying to dunk on Joey. It's just that all of the techniques that every single hot dog eater uses in the U.S. now was taken from Kobayashi's method. So even if you can eat more hot dogs than Kobayashi, I don't feel that you are more impactful or influential on this sport, because he brought the technique, he brought the showmanship, and he popularized the sport in the U.S. So it's like, what are you going to do?
I love this take, but I have to ask you, who can eat more hot dogs?
I do think that Joey does eat more hot dogs. Joey eats a shitload of hot dogs. He's a monster. I really love him. Yeah, no, I got to like, I got invited to their like after party this year, and I was like, perseverating, and I was like, oh, I'm gonna meet Joey. This is, I hope. And it was really, and yeah, I met him and he was very nice. And he's like, oh, don't you pretend to be married to me? And I was like, yes. He's like, okay, let's take a picture. And we did.
I really love that you met your crush right after your crush had eaten, what, 70 to 100 hot dogs? Like, he was just walking around with a giant hot dog belly?
He was chilling. Like, he was, I was reporting on two other eaters, Megabyte Ronnie and Mary Bowers, who are both the greatest. That's, like, part of why I like it is there's at the highest level, there are a bunch of assholes, and the way that the contest is presented can be really, really jingoistic and has been consistently. But there are competitors who are just fucking amazing and like are actively trying to change that, and I'm very interested in that effort. So I forgot what I was saying. I was just getting excited about hot dogs. But there was something that I was talking about with someone I was profiling, a woman, Mary Bowers. I was asking about, like, why are you able to have an after party? How are you not so physically ill? Like, how do you guys party after the contest? And she said it in a way that, like, I don't think it was supposed to sound like tragic, but it did feel tragic to hear, where she was like, well, you know, like, when you train the way that we do and your stomach gets really expanded, you can eat a lot, but it's impossible to ever really feel full again. So you can kind of just go out and do whatever you want. And you're like, whoa, that sounds like a biblical plague. You can never feel full again. So Joey was like full of hot dogs physically, but I don't think he felt full.
And what about eating a hot dog on a normal day? He can never feel full. Like he can never be hungry and then just eat a normal amount of food and be satiated.
I guess so. I mean, I don't know if that's, but Mary and Ronnie seem to agree that that's a generally true thing where you just have to develop a lot of discipline of like stopping yourself from eating, because once your stomach is like trained to fit that many hot dogs, you could keep going. Like you could just keep going.
Yeah, you just go to a 4th of July picnic and you're just like, people are like, dude, you're not on the clock today.
Yeah.
But you seem to imply, and I want to know if you have a firm stance on this, that after the hot dog eating contest, and this is what everybody wonders, after the hot dog eating contest, after they eat all the hot dogs and they stand there for half an hour and take all the press questions, that they do eventually go in the back and barf.
That was my theory at the time. Now I don't know. I truly don't know.
Really? Like
I feel, and I mean, because I haven't spent time with an eating champion immediately after a contest. So I'm sure that some do, but I used to, 2 years ago, I would have been like, they all definitely do, blah, blah, blah. But now I'm like, I really genuinely do not think that all of them do. I think that they're, and I don't know, also just discussing like how that physically affects you, that much food where, obviously the day after it's a lot of poop. That's just... Yeah. Physically,
absolutely.
What happens. But
I mean, I guess which way would you rather have 70 hot dogs come back out is the question.
Like, I feel like that's like a how you were raised thing. I was from like a poop family. I would rather it be poop. I don't like throwing up.
Okay, I'm really sorry to everybody who's listening to this. Maybe while you're eating or drinking, we should have maybe put a content warning on this part of it, because I know some people have very very strong feelings about this kind of thing. But I do think there's a sort of, for that reason, there's a perverse fascination with eating contests, because yes, some people watch it, but they are simultaneously so utterly revolted by it that they are horrified. And I think that's part of the appeal.
Yeah. I think that like it's that, and it's also that it's like the only like televised sport. I think it is a sport. Not everyone agrees with me there, but there's a lot of training and there's a league. So I feel like that's a sport. But I feel like it's like one of the only sports you can turn on and be like, oh, I could do that. I could do that if I really wanted to. And like, you could not, but you feel like you could in a way that feels weirdly equalizing, because like everyone has eaten too much at some point in their life.
Yes, but I eat too much for fun. I don't want to turn that into something I need to practice at. Like, eating is one of my great joys in life. I don't want to make that a hobby or a job. That would destroy the pleasure of eating.
I really, I was like, I have not achieved balance with my body image to be able to do it. But it is fascinating watching someone that can. But yeah, day one is the physical aspect. Day two, I didn't know about until I was doing interviews this year. I guess day two, there was a huge like serotonin crash from like, I don't know, just the high of being both on TV and consuming so much chemicals, that a few days later, the woman I was interviewing was like, I've like never had issues with depression, but like July 6th is the hardest day of the year for me. I get so depressed. All of my like joy chemicals are completely depleted. And then by July 8th, I'm back. But it's like a precarious couple of days, like mentally and physically. It's wild.
Well, surely not the first person to get depressed because they ate hot dogs. I think
no, I can speak
I think
to that.
We've all been there. But I'd love to just end on, God, this has been such a wonderful tour de force you've taken us on. And by the way, for our Patreon subscribers, we are going to be doing a book club with you where we've read the book together and we're going to be having a nice live chat with the author over Zoom. It's going to be so much fun. Head to patreon.com/AdamConover if you want to join. You don't have to have read the book to join, but if you have and you want to, you can. For a fun final question, I just want to ask, what is your perfect hot dog? You describe so many hot dogs. The bun, are we talking grilled? Are we talking... Is the bun grilled, blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. You know, could you assemble in your mind for us what your ideal hot dog would be of all of the components that you have tasted over the course of your journey so we can all imagine it together.
Yes. So just before I say it, this is the perfect hot dog for me. And it's not going to be the perfect hot dog for everybody. And if you like things that I don't, that's okay. And you don't need to contact me about it. And that's fine.
Don't ask Jamie. It? Don't yuck her yum. All right.
I just am so afraid of Chicago hot dog fans.
Oh my God. You took such a brave stance against the Chicago hot dog. You think I was brave for saying the New York hot dogs were not bad, which is just obviously true. So for saying they were bad.
Yeah.
But you saying, and I was like, Jamie is, she's in danger.
I
like,
got booed at my own book release show in Chicago. It was... I really fucked around and found out with Chicago.
Chicago people are so, look, Chicago's a wonderful city, but they're insecure about it. They're insecure and defensive.
In a way that's not necessary. It's great there.
I understand why they feel that way, you know, on, you know, the Third Coast and all that, right? It doesn't get the love it deserves as a city. I agree with that.
Sure.
But as a result, they're defensive about things that they are not actually that great. That's all. Much love to everybody in Chicago, but you know, have some self-confidence is what I would say.
Just grab a bottle of ketchup and, you know, chug it. my perfect
hot dog. Oh my God, the ketchup people. Oh, the fuck ketchup, you. All right.
It's a lot. So I do put ketchup on my hot dog and not everyone's going to be okay with that.
I love it.
I toast the bun. I love a toasted bun. I feel like it just gives you more. I love a half smoke, but most importantly, I want my hot dog split and grilled. That is critical.
I love
because then you get extra char, and then you get a little passage for your ketchup, your mustard, your relish. And that's what I do. I do a standard hot dog. I'm not picky about what's in it. But as far as like the meat, I like an all beef hot dog, but I'm flexible there. Split, grilled, toasted bun, ketchup, mustard, relish, done.
You're making me hungry right now, despite knowing all the horrible facts that I know about how hot dogs are made. and that contradiction is at the soul of this book, and that's what I love so much about it. That made me revolted and hungry at the same time, just like I feel when watching Joey Chestnut scarf down 70 hot dogs.
Exactly.
And so the book's called Raw Dog. I really hope people check it out. You can join us on Patreon for our book club at patreon.com/AdamConover. Jamie, where can people find you and follow your work?
You can follow me on, I guess Instagram is the best place right now, at Jamie Christ Superstar. And I am curious about new, when I was going on the book tour, I found out even more hot dog facts that fascinated and revolted me. And I feel like I could keep talking about hot dogs forever. So if you have a fascinating hot dog anecdote, I am amenable. I would like to know what it is.
Oh my God. We'll get those in the book club. And by the way, if you want to pick up a copy of the book, you can get it at factuallypod.com/books. Jamie Loftus, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. This is so fun.
Well, thank you once again to Jamie for coming on the show. Again, if you want to pick up a copy of the book, you can get it at factuallypod.com/books. Hope you do. It's wonderful. And you can join us on our Patreon book club in just a couple weeks if you're interested. If you want to join that book club, that URL is patreon.com/AdamConover. $5 a month gets you every episode of the show ad-free. All those great community features. For $15 a month, I will read your name on this very show. So I want to thank Ryan Cowler, John McAvee, Scott Kaler, Algie Williams, and Doug Arley, and everybody else who supports the show at the $15 a month level. I want to thank my producers, Tony Wilson and Sam Roudman, everybody here at HeadGum for making the show possible. If you want to find my tickets and tour dates, head to adamconover.net. I'm at Adam Conover, wherever you get your social media. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time on Factually.
That was a HeadGum podcast.